You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
So some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be sharing his hopes for disability employment for 2026. So what are your hopes for ECC for the year ahead?
Well, I think the biggest hope at the moment is that the government will see the benefit of a national disability insurance plan and start looking at ways to find out from, you know, disabled Canadians and all Canadians for that matter, whether a national disability insurance plan is feasible, viable, and desirable. So that's our main goal, of course, always has been and will continue to be. But it is time for the government to start picking up on that and start looking and putting some resources into this to make it a reality. But as you know, what we're trying to do is a nonpartisan issue. And so we're hoping to get some positive feedback when that's read out loud in Parliament.
So
Go ahead with the question.
So what would the next step be after a parliamentary reading?
Within 30 days, I believe, the government has to respond to that being read out. So then based on that response, whether they'll say, you know, this is a great idea, we're going to put resources into this right away, or whether they say, you know, this sounds nice, we'll put it on the shelf for another 10 years and not worry about it. So that'll give us kind of an idea of where we should then be directing our focus. So, and in the meantime, political parties will all be having conventions and so our strategy for that is to give them the wording that they need so that they can put a national disability insurance plan into their platform to try to get elected for the next election. We've done this before with the Liberal Party about 2.5-3 years ago, where it became quite close to being one of their major party platforms. So we want this to be on all the political parties' platforms as a major thing to move forward to get them elected.
So if it turns out that this is something they attempt to shelve or sweep under the rug, are there any particular routes you can take just to keep it in the forefront to make sure progress is being made?
I think it's going to have to then become, you know, we are grassroots. We want the people with disabilities, those that are affected the most, to pick up the rally and in capital letters, you know, demand a publicly funded national disability insurance plan. So that's going to have to be a lot louder and a lot clearer with stories from people with developmental intellectual disabilities and all disabilities, physical, invisible disabilities. Everybody really needs to get on the bandwagon and start screaming louder. As an association, every Canadian Council has been doing this for over a decade, And sometimes you kind of feels like you're screaming into the void. I know, and we know, that this is an extremely positive program that Canada needs, and not just for the disabled people, but Canada in general. Canadians will all benefit from this program, both morally and financially, from a business perspective. So we just need to keep pounding away, get more real just residents from Canada to put pressure on their members of parliament. You know, we're doing what we can from a political level, also from a social platforms that we keep pounding away at. But we need more people to do that. We need more people on board to start screaming louder to their members of parliament, especially if they attempt to shelve this, that we need to be at the actual door of the members of parliament with people with disabilities to demand something better. They know that something better is available, can be available, like it is in Australia, and we have a wonderful template to follow there, only make it better, learn from their mistakes. So there's no reason why this shouldn't be happening in Canada for human rights. The Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities all demand for Canada to do this, and Canada has agreed to do this, has just never moved forward with it. So it's just going to have to be continued pressure.
So what are some steps that individuals can take just in their own homes if they're saying to themselves, I want to get more involved, I want to take action to improve things for the disability community?
Yeah, if they don't have, you know, exactly what to say and how to say it, they can always reach out to us, info@everycanadiancounts.com, and we'll get in touch with them as soon as possible to say, these are the talking points, these are the things you should be telling your member of parliament. It's not much good to be telling other disabled people that there's a problem. There is a time now where all disabled people, their families, supporters, approach their members of parliament and put pressure. So they have to actually do something about it instead of just complaining about it. We have the strategy, I believe, to make this happen. We have the plan. It's just we need more people to force and to put a pressure on the government. And that's all levels. So whoever your local member of parliament is, or even your opposition, it doesn't matter. Anybody that's in government, members of parliament, we have all their names. We have all their contact information. So if somebody's looking for that, they can reach out to us at that info@everycanadiancounts.com, and we can send the contact information for their member of parliament. But really, it's just a simple Google search, who's my member of parliament in this area? So, and then make an appointment. Go see them and tell them that you're not, you know, Canada's not meeting its obligation. You are not getting what you need because of your disability under human rights, and that you demand a national disability insurance plan, because that's the only thing I can see being all-inclusive, being portable across the country from all levels, and do those ones with lifelong disabilities to go into a separate plan that will allow them movement across the country, give them support based on the need that they have, whether that's, you know, mobility needs, home and vehicle modifications, all the equipment they would need, the electronics, anything that would be associated with their disability would be covered by such a plan. So, you know, it does boil down to taxpayers paying for this, but in the end, all taxpayers will benefit because of the added dimension to the economy that this would bring. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks, Cam.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Rabbi Aketter will be giving us an update on Disability Without Poverty. So I understand that you've been doing some work in the world of disability sport, as well as your work with Disability Without Poverty.
I have my fingers in many pies, Cam.
So can you give me an overview of some of the disability sport highlights and its connection to some of the poverty issues as well?
Well, like for me myself, as an immigrant kid, you know, sport wasn't something that my parents thought about. And on top of that, I had a disability. So even participating in sports activities was very limited in school, and educators weren't creative enough to find ways to include me. So, you know, as an adult, being blind and having four young children, I decided that I was going to make sure that my kids fully participate in everything and anything that I could get them into. And so that's where, you know, the idea of sport and recreation came into my world. And I got involved in creating women-only swimming programs just to accommodate our faith-based needs and stuff like that, so my girls could learn to swim. We got involved in a community skating program to get our kids skating, but also engage other kids in skating. And we had people wanting to come with their wheelchair on the ice that regular skate programs wouldn't allow for, but we negotiated and advocated and, you know, got somebody who loves to be on the ice in her wheelchair to do that. In the space of soccer, had many individuals expressing interest in wanting, you know, something to do, and they can't play a regular game, and they couldn't do, you know, even competitive games within disability space. So we created a drop-in space for them to be able to play as they can, modified soccer activities, drills, but they get a jersey, they get, you know, a trophy, they get all of that, a team picture, and they really feel the spirit, you know, because it's really about the spirit of the sport. Most recently, I met a bunch of people who wanted to play cricket, and they're all visually impaired or blind. And I should say, you know, I have low or no vision because I don't like the term visually impaired, as you know. Yes. And so for the first time in my life, I actually held a cricket bat and figured out how they play cricket. I mean, they don't shoot up. They shoot across the turf on the ground to make it more accessible in other ways as well. So I supported those individuals in launching the Canadian Blind Cricket Association. And, you know, my husband also dabbles in soccer, so soccer's been a part of our lives in different ways in community life.
So I'm kind of curious about the skater you mentioned in the wheelchair. How did they make the adaptation to make that work?
She just wants to be on the ice in her wheelchair. That's it. There's like, she has significant disabilities, so she really has a very specialized chair. She's not verbal, significant physical disabilities. So there's no way she could just put on a pair of skates and get on there with any kind of support. So she just likes to be on the ice and wants people to push her around. So, you know what? I mean, one of the cutest moments was my husband was pushing her around and a whole bunch of kids made a little train behind him pushing her around the skating rink.
So, in that sense, your work creating accessibility in sport would seem to tie into eradicating some of the issues of poverty, because, as we know, sports can be kind of expensive, and creating a space for people with disabilities in the way that they can actually just drop in and participate in seems like a terrific idea.
So. Yeah, it's really about making it accessible and affordable. And we know that for most families living with disabilities, they're not living affluent lives, because especially if there's an individual with a significant developmental disability, that means that there's somebody in their lives, in their household, who had to give up a career or minimize their labor market attachment to earn income in order to provide care. So therefore, financial resources are very limited, and sport is really privileged in our society. It's really very costly.
So that being said, I know there are significant benefits for someone with a disability to be in sport, being a part of the community, being able to just use the abilities they do have. And it shouldn't be denied to them based on something like an income level, at least I don't think.
Absolutely. And, you know, municipalities and corporations do offer some subsidies for people in those situations, but oftentimes it's not just even the cost, it's the creativity and opportunity out there for people to participate.
So in your work with disability and sport and in your work with the disability poverty community, is there any success story or moment, recent memory you'd like to share?
In terms of specifically what?
In your work to create open opportunities for those living in poverty with accessible needs, just to be a part of sport.
Well, I'm really proud of the Access Kicks program that we have running at Dean Support Services in collaboration with a community-based house league of youth soccer. We collaborate with them. They get us uniforms and they give us the equipment and even volunteer with us, and we recruit volunteers and we recruit young people to work with us. And we have about, you know, 40 to 50 young men and women who come out to kick around a soccer ball and run around and just work out and do drills. And, you know, we try to work with them where they are at in terms of their abilities. And they are so happy for that hour. And their parents are and families that come to support them also build those informal connections with one another. And we really see this sense of community evolving, a sense of belonging emerging.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Handy Link, we'll be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee wants to teach you how to be an ally. Listen, be open to learning from the experience of others. Believe, support survivors and those affected by violence. Speak out. Add your voice to call out violence. Intervene. Find a safe way to help when you see acts of gender-based violence. Act. Give your time to organizations working to end violence and be the change you want to see. A message from the Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee at the University of Windsor.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Hubert van Niekerk gave us an update on Every Canadian Counts, and we heard about disability in sport and how it ties into issues of poverty from Rabia Ketter. In this segment of our show, Jeff Beach will be telling us a little bit about Asthma Canada. So what can you tell me about Asthma Canada?
So Asthma Canada is a national health charity that was established over 50 years ago to help improve the lives and understanding of people living with asthma. Asthma is one of the most common chronic diseases that face people in Canada and across the world, and can certainly be life-limiting and oftentimes life-threatening as well.
So how do you reach out to those who could potentially benefit from your work?
So we, as an organization that's been around for a number of years, we have several partnerships within healthcare systems, health providers, family doctors, specialists, et cetera, that often will refer people to us for information and resources that we offer. We also, in the digital age that we're living in, we're quite active digitally as well on different social platforms and so forth, and really trying to reach people where they are. So one of the examples of things that we do is we provide an asthma and allergy helpline that's available free of charge. It's available by email or by telephone. And what we do when someone calls or emails in is we have a team of certified respiratory educators that people can ask any questions that they have about their asthma, or if they're caring for someone, a child living with asthma, for example, a parent wants to call in. We have that open-ended free service that's available. And then we also offer a number of different educational resources through our website. We have information booklets that can be downloaded. We have some webinars that we offer as well, which are all available on YouTube. So we're continuously trying to reach out and ensure that people are aware of the fact that we're here and that we can help and we can provide information that can help them understand their asthma and live better with their asthma.
So that being the case, it's interesting you brought up about having educators. I'd imagine there are some myths and misconceptions about asthma that are still out there.
You're absolutely correct, there are. And so that's one of the biggest challenges that we face as an organization, is that there are some misunderstandings or myths about the disease, one of which is that it's not as serious as it actually is. You know, many people, for whatever reason, tend to downplay their disease. Sometimes it's related to stigma. You know, kids don't want to stand out. If it's a child with asthma that's at school or in a gym class or participating in a team sports activity, they don't want to have to stop and use their medication at times when they really should be. There's been a stigma, unfortunately, especially with children over time, where the kid with asthma, the kid with the puffer is somehow different, somehow weaker than other kids, when really, we live in a time where we should be able to explain what the disease is so that people understand it and that there are good treatment options available. Another myth is that asthma just magically sort of goes away. And particularly, I hear a lot of people say things like, oh, I've outgrown my asthma. In some ways, that is true, but the actual facts behind it show that the asthma is not something that just magically goes away. It may change in terms of how it affects people and the kinds of symptoms that are present, but it can, certainly those symptoms can come back. And I know, just sharing my own experiences myself, whereas as a young adult, I was diagnosed with asthma and had a lot of difficulties with symptoms. And then as time went by, those symptoms tended to go away. But in recent years, with the wildfires, the smoke from the wildfires and other concerns, I've seen some of my symptoms come back, and I've had to adjust my medication plan. So there are a lot of misconceptions, mostly around the severity of the disease and also the fact that it's not something that people need to take seriously.
So having lived through it yourself, I want to speak to that point you made about children being stigmatized. Do you have any advice for those out there who might be experiencing that as to how they can get around those barriers?
I think it really comes down to understanding and education for others as well. And so we've done things for kids, for example. We have a program that we just launched in the last 6 or 8 months called Mission Breathe, which is an educational game, like a video game that's available through our website, that teaches kids about asthma, what it is, why it's important that they use their rescue medication or their controller medication on a daily basis, and then helping them talk to others about it. So what I would encourage people to do is to be open, to be honest about it, and to let people around them know that they have asthma. For kids in school, it's really important, and actually it is a requirement that be disclosed by the parents to the school so that they can be aware and equipped if there is an issue. There was a high-profile case in Ontario back, I want to say around 2014 or so, maybe a little bit before that, where a young student actually died in a school because he didn't have access to his asthma medication. So that at that time, organizations like ours, Asthma Canada, and some of the other lung health organizations advocated to government to ensure that kids in school do have ready access to their medication. So it's just really important to be upfront, to be honest about it, and to share with others, because I think once people see what asthma actually is and that it's inflammatory disease, but it can be controlled by medication, then it sort of lessens that that stigma. And people aren't as anxious about talking about it or anxious about having symptoms during a time when they don't want others to see them having those symptoms.
So in your time with Asthma Canada, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
I think for us, the one thing that really has been a game changer over the last decade or so has been the advent of biologic treatments, which are advanced treatments that actually help people living with severe forms of asthma that up until the last decade or so were not treatable. In the sense that people were using traditional medications like corticosteroids and so forth, which do help but are not good for someone to use in on a long-term basis. Biologics actually work on the physiology of the lungs and the disease, and it's not, they're certainly not a cure, but they provided effective control, and people's quality of life has dramatically increased. You know, we've some of our patient community members have shared their stories where, you know, they were people who could barely climb the stairs in their home without being out of breath. And since they've been on biologics, they've been able to work and go to school and do things that that they want to and should be able to. So that certainly stands out. I would also point to the launch of our research strategy over the last couple of years, where we're providing funding to Canadian researchers to really develop better understanding of the disease and the comorbidities that are associated with it. I think that's another thing that asthma presents that people don't necessarily see, where, you know, people with asthma often have symptoms related to allergies, and there are certain types of asthma that are directly related to allergies. Asthma can also lead to a lack of sleep because symptoms are often present at night, so then that is kind of a cascading effect on people's health as well. We talked earlier about the stigma, which can really create a lot of anxiety, and people are anxious about doing things because they don't want to be out and perhaps triggering an exacerbation or an asthma attack while they're out in public. So that affects people's mental health. So there are a lot of comorbidities to the disease as well. But I think we're really reaching people now, especially through digital means, in a much bigger capacity, and hopefully providing them with that education and that support that they need to be able to understand their disease and also to help other people around them, their family members, their co-workers, classmates, teachers, to understand the disease as well.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, no problem.
Thanks. Friends, I love the idea of Mission Breathe. I've always found the best way to reach out to somebody about their condition and to really engage with them is to do it in a cool, relatable way, whether it be art, music, TV, what have you. The best way to reach somebody is in a way that they can put themselves into, something they can look at and see a reflection of their own story. I've always said people will ignore a statistic, but they won't ignore a story. It's a lot harder to look away from someone when you know this is a living, breathing human being with hopes, dreams, goals all their own. Honestly, people might look at a statistic, find it overwhelming, and say, yeah, that's a tragedy, but the problem's so big, we're not going to try to do anything about it. It's not always a matter of tackling the big issues at once. It can be a matter of helping the individual, taking the small wins where you can. And if you can really reach someone in a way that speaks to them, chances are they'll reach out to another. Before you know it, you have a wave of effect. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.